Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome once again to Progressive News Network. I play that song tonight instead of our typical one because I want to bring your attention to a few important things that are facing us right now. The president has suggested that we have a new Treasury Secretary straight from Wall Street. And you know what? He thinks that the deregulation of Wall Street is no problem at all. And they can mix and mingle their speculation. And it had nothing to do with those prime rates. How about that? Pretty nice, huh? Well, we've got a real good show for you tonight. Our first guest tonight is going to be Susan Hawaii, who is not only from Fort Lauderdale's Occupy, but she is the foreclosure expert who works with families across the community to help them keep their homes, to face down the bankers, face down the sheriff, and to give you some really good advice on how, if you're faced with foreclosure or someone in your community is faced with the foreclosure people, how they can face it up and stop people from having their homes taken away. Then we've got State Representative Mark Pafford, who's going to talk to us about some of the issues that we've got facing the state right now as we approach that launch of the new legislative session. And then we've got Jeff Clemons, a senator, a brand new Democratic progressive senator in Tallahassee. And he's already got some bills in motion, and he's going to talk to us about those. And then we have another special guest, a gentleman named Sky Nelson, who is a physicist, musician, and Progressive Democrats of America activist, who's going to talk to us a little bit about what he's doing with his work in physics, and also he's going to talk a little bit about his Florida tour that's upcoming right now. So we've got some real nice entertainment for you tonight, good informative information, and first, as they say, the news. We've got some events to let you know about. There is a Move to Amend event at Lake Worth City Commission. Slavery is the legal fiction that people are property. Corporate personhood is the legal fiction that property is a person. That's by William Myers. Tuesday the 15th, Lake Worth City Hall at 6 North Dixie Highway in Lake Worth. At 6 p.m. there's a commission meeting. The phone contact for more information is Linda Wheel. And that's 561-729-1939. And the email contact is Joni Albrecht. And that's albrechtmd@earthlink.net. The Lake Worth City Commission, at their regular 6 p.m. city meeting, will be voting on a resolution supporting an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would return constitutional rights to people only and prevent corporations from being given the same rights as humans, as was done by the 2010 Supreme Court decision misnamed Citizens United versus FEC. Such resolutions have been passed by hundreds of local governments, and they're looking for your support. Humanists of the Treasure Coast are having a potluck dinner and get-together Saturday the 19th, and that's at 416 14th Ave in Vero Beach. If you go to humtc.org, you can get more information, or you can call 772-257-6774. Also, the Progressive Coalition The Democratic Caucus of Progressives is having a meeting on January 27th, and that's going to be at Lake Mary Marriott. Everyone's welcome to attend. For more information, go to www.progressivedemcaucusfl.org. I'll go ahead and spell that again. It's a great place to meet other progressives from across the state. These are great progressive activists who are doing things to make this a better world. And that's progressivedemcaucusfl.org. Also coming up in February is the Progressive Democratic Caucus's LegiCamp, an annual event where you can hear how people are preparing for the legislative session ahead, how progressives can have the maximum amount of impact. LegiCamp is Saturday, February 9th, 2013, and that's from 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, and that'll be in Orlando. The venue hasn't been decided yet, and it's hosted by Florida Progressives, a coalition that in 2011 organized a collective action known as Awake the State. Monday, the 14th, FAU's Peace Studies Department at Boca Campus is having a lecture by Judith LeBlanc, Peace Action. And that's AL-189, the FAU Boca Raton Campus, 4 p.m. to 5:30, Reflections on the U.S. Peace and Justice Movement. Palm Beach Now will be hosting the 40th Annual Susan B. Anthony Feminist of the Year Award, and that's on February 10th. And if you support your sisters, make sure you go to that event and salute the 40th Annual Susan B. Anthony Feminist of the Year Award by Palm Beach Now. Okay, with other news, you've got to be aware. There is an event coming up, and this is going to be Thursday the 17th. If you may be aware of the environment issues at all facing our state, for years, the state of Florida has been suing the EPA because, well, let's see, the EPA wanted to protect our water using quantifiable scientific methods, whereas the state of Florida would rather say, hey, yeah, it looks okay to me. Hey, no problem. Well, after years and years of litigation with the state of Florida fighting the EPA, the EPA is prepared right now to throw in the towel and basically say, you know what? It's too much trouble for us to regulate Florida's waters. Clearly, Florida doesn't give a dang. So we're just going to let the Florida Department of Environment, that's the DEP, we're just going to let them take over. You know, what the heck? So if you think this is a bad idea, there's a wonderful group of organizations pulling together for an event in Tampa on January 17th to tell the EPA that we demand environmental protection since the state has abnegated its responsibilities. The EPA has announced they are handing over protection of 15% of Florida's waterways to the State Department of Environmental Protection. The DEP rules are far less strict and enforced than those of the EPA. The DEP rules are not only less strict, the enforcement has been left to friends of the big polluters rather than environmental professionals. It's no joke that the people say the DEP stands for Don't Expect Protection. What's worse, the EPA is considering handing over the rest of Florida's waters to DEP also. That would be a huge setback for all of us working to protect the waters. So for more information, that's going to be the demonstration, press conference in March to the EPA information session. That's Thursday the 17th, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. It's going to be in downtown Tampa, Franklin Street Pedestrian Mall between Kennedy Boulevard and East Jackson. If you're a West Coaster and you care at all about the environment, make sure you check this out. Okay, more Fook news. As the Fukushima work goes on, people are asking, is anything getting done? More than a year and a half since the nuclear crisis, most of Japan's post-Fukushima cleanup remains primitive, slapdash, and bereft of cleanup methods lauded by government scientists as effective in removing harmful radioactive cesium. Fukushima cleanup crews are cutting corners. This is from the Japan Times. The crooked cleanup, the environmental ministry failed to act on the Akashi tip-off. It seems that, where do you hear this? This is from the Ashi Shimbun. Environmental Ministry officials in December received detailed and photographic evidence of shoddy decontamination work in Fukushima Prefecture, but they dithered on taking action, citing manners and the need to confirm the information. The Environmental Minister, Nobutero Ishihara, has been slow to react since the Shimbun ran its first story on the 4th of January. Ashi Shimbun reporters, who witnessed slipshod work at the 13 locations between December 11th and 18th, visited the site and saw workers emptying contaminated materials into rivers and alongside of the roads. Hey, no problem there. Well, listen, let me get on to our important guests. So this first one is Susan Hawaii from the Fort Lauderdale Occupy, who is their foreclosure expert. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Susan Hawaii from Occupy Fort Lauderdale, who has been helping people as a foreclosure specialist. Susan, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
The Occupy movement has done so many wonderful things, has given so many people a voice, a chance to speak out, something more than just suffering under this terrible corporatist banker giveaway. And I want to salute you first just as an Occupy person. We've had several on here, and the spirit that they have shown has been, I think, just energizing. So first, thank you as being an Occupy person. And then I want to thank you especially for working on the foreclosure problem, which if there's any need more basic than food or as basic as food, it's shelter. And you're helping people deal with the problems of these bankers taking away, with the help of law enforcement, to take away the roof over their heads. So thank you for that as well. Now that we've got the thanks out of the way, let me ask you, before we get into the foreclosure effort, could you talk a little bit about yourself as a person? I have always had the utmost respect for activists who, beyond the burdens of home and family and friends and work, decide that that's not enough, that they have to help out their society. They give their efforts, they give their strength to making this a better world. Could you talk a bit about yourself personally, and what was it in your life that made you, that compelled you to help out, to make this a better world?
Thank you, Rick. I was born into an activist family.
Oh, that's great.
It didn't change as I grew older. In fact, it got worse. I saw more injustice, more poverty, and I couldn't help but just jump in and try and help where I can. A couple of years ago, one of my occupier friends, he enlarged his mortgage statement, and when I saw it, he was paying $1,200 a month in interest and 87 cents in principal.
Oh, my God.
That made no kind of sense to me. And so bringing my 10 years of working as a legal secretary, paralegal experience, I got together with him, and we thought that together, because he was into construction and he knew the construction business, and he was surprised that this is where he's at today, and my life experience as an activist working with attorneys and trade unions, I figured maybe we could start our own Occupy Foreclosure Working Group.
Awesome.
And that's how the Working Group for Foreclosures was born.
Oh, that's super. You know, there's been, it's almost mind-boggling to me, considering the range of trouble that has come to this country from the excesses of the bank speculators, and to see how few champions have stood up, and I mean, you can almost count them on one hand. Elizabeth Warren stands out in my mind as one of the few people who's actually said something that was so eloquent to me because of its simplicity. She said, why would these credit companies have all that tiny print? And there's only one excuse, because they don't want you to know what's going on.
Precisely. And their language is convoluted. So you have homeowners, and the demographic that I work in is predominantly low-income black and brown families.
Uh-huh.
And when they're served, when the process server comes to their door, and they're served with this stack of paper that they don't understand, they're terrified. They're paralyzed. And I have used my experience to explain some of these documents because it took me back. I, with all my 10-year experience, when I looked at some of these things, I said to myself, what? This makes no sense. It took about eight or nine months for me to wrap my brain around what the banks, quote, aka their services, the government, the police, what they, all their various parts in this play. And that the homeowners, because they didn't understand English, because they don't understand how the courts operate, were just left blowing in the wind.
Absolute victims. Absolute victims.
And so what we have done as a group, we would go to the courthouse and we would sit in the courtrooms. We would talk to people. We would let the judges know that we are watching them. And there are many times when I have stood up, because normally I would wear my Occupy t-shirt under a jacket.
Right.
And I would look like any other normal person. But when one of my homeowners, who I know does not have an attorney, goes before that judge, I would stand up, take my jacket off. Nine out of ten times, we would be able to accomplish either a 120-day extension, or, which I find to be absolutely fascinating, the judge would look at that homeowner and pretty much tell that homeowner what his or her next pleading is supposed to be.
So even the judges are appalled.
The judges, with this particular judge, it was just phenomenal. And so it really helped those homeowners. But I don't have enough homeowners coming to me. For instance, yesterday I was in the courtroom. I was the only non-attorney in the courtroom. We have 1,900 foreclosures filed every month in Broward County. And that is not including the 60,000 that is pending right now in the courthouse. So where are all these homeowners?
They're lost. They're confused. They think they have no options. They think they have no resources. They don't know what you're doing.
And I have been trying desperately to get them to me. You know, we hand flyers out. We talk to people. I ask them, pass it on, word of mouth. Let's do this. We have been able to save quite a few families.
That's
and we've also been able to take advantage of some of the federal programs. For instance, I have a family who has been able to access the Florida Hardest Hit Fund.
Really?
Yeah.
You mean a person has actually benefited? A family has benefited?
Yes. She will now get her mortgage paid for 1 year while she tries to find her job.
Wow. That's... it's so amazing.
It is, but not many people know that Florida Hardest Hit Fund is available. It's a little complicated.
Sure, I bet.
You have to be patient, and everything is done online. So that in itself creates another problem, because some of my families don't have access to computers.
I almost am hesitant to ask this, but, you know, faced with this kind of dilemma, where you've got these predatory lenders, you got the predatory banks, you got the law working in basically at their behest. Simultaneously, we've got an economic downturn where jobs have fled. What few jobs are left are so poorly paid. It seems like if you know, it's kind of like one of those things you push down here, but something else pops up over there. It's such an across the board dilemma. If you were to wave your magic wand and look into the future, what kind of things do you think it would take to improve the lot of the working poor?
The first thing I would do, and I have suggested this, is we have a moratorium on foreclosure and all foreclosure-related activity, starting yesterday. That would give homeowners some breathing space. I don't know how we're going to bring jobs back to the United States. I can't speak for that. But I know that if we stop this foreclosure train and regroup as a society, as a community, we might be able to save some of our homes. We might be able to save some money. The Occupy movement, in some cases, have been able to house families in vacant homes, homes that are owned by banks, but the banks forget they exist. And sometimes these families just need to be there for 2 or 3 months. They save enough money, and then they're probably able to move on to another state where they have friends and family who would help them for the next couple of months. But that moratorium on foreclosures, I think, would be a first good step.
You know, another thing that keeps coming to my mind whenever I consider this whole foreclosure dilemma. Okay, quote, the banks were made whole, okay?
Yes.
Their exposure was reduced. They got a penny on a dollar. I mean, they got a dollar for a dollar, penny for a penny. And yet, the people who are hanging out there still exposed are the mortgage holders. The TARP benefit was supposed to benefit in its very design, the homeowners too, not just the bankers. And it seems to me that if corporations are people too, man, where's the punishment for these incredibly misbehaving, criminal behavior of the bankers who put people into situations, these balloon loans that they knew, these liar loans, that they couldn't do it. They knew it so well that they bet against these people actually paying their mortgages off. So where's their penalty? Where's their gotcha? Where's their even-handed, you know, everybody loses a little, where's the pain for everyone? It seems the pain's been shifted entirely to the working poor. And when I say working poor, I'm talking about what used to be called the middle class, because clearly the middle class doesn't exist anymore.
That is correct. And I personally would like to see Jamie Dimon and the heads of all the five major banks in jail. I think we should have a very special jail for them. But that's not going to happen anytime soon. I bought and sold our government 10 times over.
And I'm betting you don't mean one of those country clubs.
Oh, no. Nothing. I want that. I mean, we should create... I was thinking of, Alcatraz. Let's reopen Alcatraz. That would be my first thing.
Or these people were enemy of the state. Maybe Guantanamo is the place for them.
Good thought. And so, as much as I want to see them in jail, they will not get there until the homeowners I work with and the homeowners across this country say enough is enough and get out into the streets. If we get out into the streets in our millions, because this crisis has not affected 2 people or 3 people. In the state of Florida, for the last 5 years, we've had 1,274,919 foreclosures. That is approximately 6 million people. If we say conservatively, 4 people lived in each one of those homes. Why are we not seeing all these millions of people in the streets demanding from our government and our representatives that something be done to Fannie and Freddie so that they grant principal reductions? Why are we not in the streets shutting down the states as we go along to make sure that our voices are heard?
Well, I think I can give you one reason. I think that the ruling powers, with their abuse of the peaceful protesters of Occupy, tried to set a lesson that if you dare speak up, you'll be beaten, you'll be sprayed in the face with industrial strength poisons, and that they did their utmost from the very beginning to make sure that people knew that if they stood up against this abuse, they would be beaten and they would regret it. I think that's the reason why we have seen the pullback of should we say, the visible presence of Occupy as a camp-out maneuver. I don't think Occupy has been tampered with in the long run. I think the spirit is still there. But I think they made a point. And if you saw any of those FBI documents,
yes,
that detail what their working plans were, they did everything they could to establish the fact that, oh, they were for freedom of speech. They were just worried about terrorists.
Yes.
That's why they planned to have snipers out there to take out the leaders.
Yeah, and, you know, that really upset me because I am one of those leaders. And to know that there's a quote-unquote bullet with my name on it does not make me very happy.
Well, you know, that also seems to me to show their utter disdain for democracy and for the basic principles of this government as initially established. Because the right to petition for redress of grievances is in the founding documents. And when they talk about spying on people just who are gathering, oh yeah, they're observing the fact that they can peacefully assemble. Excuse me, no. No, that's not what all those terrorist centers were doing. That's not what all those FBI agents were doing. That's not what they were doing when they were meeting with banker security. No. Not at all.
But I believe that if we get into the streets by our millions, there is not enough prisons to arrest all of us. Sure, they're going to make our life difficult. Yes, we're going to. Some of us are going to get arrested. Some of us are going to get pepper sprayed. But there will be a pushback. And if we see one group doing it, hopefully others will be inspired and take to the streets.
Well, I have to tell you, Susan, I am so honored to have you as a guest on this show. Your work on behalf of people who've had their homes stolen, I'm not going to use any other word for it, stolen by a system intent on wringing every drop of blood out of American homeowners. You know, when you hear stories about banks foreclosing on homes, they don't even own.
That's right.
Don't even own. You have to say...
That is correct. They don't owe them. And some of the times, the family does not even have a mortgage with that bank.
And, you know, you have to wonder. I don't think an apology does the trick. I don't think that a slap on the wrist to these bankers that were across the board practicing this kind of policy, a slap on the wrist of 1 month's profits, has anything to do with what's really going on. And
no.
An $8,000 gift or sop or crumb, if you want to call it that, when they've stolen your home, you know, that just speaks to what I'm going to call a physicality. The stress, the shortening of life, the bad health that comes from having to deal with this, This is criminal. It's an assault.
And we have had people commit suicide because their homes, they know that the police is going to come the next morning and evict them from their home. So at some point in time, the people, the homeowners, have to get up and say enough is enough. This settlement, where they're going to, the recent settlement with the OCC,
right,
that does not help homeowners. How are they going to find the homeowners who've left their home, who've left the state, who are probably living in shelters? Where are they going to send that check?
I think the lawyers will just divvy it up in the end.
They probably will, because there is no way they can find some of these people. And so this settlement with the OCC is just another game, another way of trying to tell the people that we've done something. When in reality, you've just shifted the money around to all the other players, all the players who were there in the first place, because no homeowners were able to sit in on these negotiations.
No. Well, I have a lot of hope for Elizabeth Warren, the new senator, and she really seems to be speaking for working people.
Yes.
And I have to tell you, the work that you're doing, I'm going to get my little brain trust together here and see what we can suggest to you. I'm thinking maybe we can get to you some PSAs that might be played on some of the local radio stations to help reach out, because clearly your message, the message of your help being available, and of course it's not just happening in Fort Lauderdale or in the east coast of Florida, it's happening all across the Florida. We have to find...
It's happening all across the state. So many people, and I have people calling me from as far as Pennsylvania. It's terrible what has happened. And to know that, you know, for instance, the new Treasury Secretary. Now, I have a problem with him because he once said that...
The deregulation had nothing to do with it. Yeah, yeah, I heard that. Of course, he also got $900,000 that we know of from Citibank. So, yeah, he's...
Yeah, he didn't think that deregulation was part of the housing crash. He didn't think that deregulation drove it.
Go ahead, read it.
I have the Lou quote right here. It says, I don't personally know the extent to which deregulation drove it, meaning the housing crisis.
Right.
But I don't believe that deregulation was the proximate cause.
Well, maybe he's going philosophical, and he's pointing to the fact that it's really greed and callous, soulless behavior on the part of bankers and mortgage holders. Susan?
Okay. Okay, if you say so.
But yeah, absolutely. He's going to be a real new kind of Treasury Secretary because, well, after all, you know, kinder and gentle.
My choice for Treasury Secretary was going to be Paul Krugman. But, you know, obviously that didn't happen, so...
Or Robert Reich.
My other choice was William Black from...
Oh, now you're talking. Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't know the name of Mr. Black, he is an economist investigator. And he has spoken so much truth with Bill Moyers all across the web. He's been on the Democracy Now! Regularly. Check out, I think it's William Black. Just check him out, William Black, economic investigator and truth speaker. An incredible guy. Susan, as we wrap up, let me ask you this. If there's a message you would give out to our progressive community out there across the state, what would you say to them? What do they need to know about foreclosure, and how can they help the problem?
Stand with your neighbor for every eviction defense. Stay in your home if you are in foreclosure and fight it. Do not let the banks win. And if you need any kind of help, come to the Occupy movement.
Susan, thank you so much. I hope you come back regularly and give us reports on how things are going. I don't want this to be, telling tales and talking about people's individual woes. But this is more than about individual people. This is about a system that is trying to destroy the basic human dream of having your own shelter. And the game has been rigged so badly. And I have to just say thank you for the work that you do to protect families.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I hope you come back again soon.
I will. Thank you very much.
Susan, how can they get in touch with Occupy Fort Lauderdale?
You could get in touch with us through Facebook page. We have Occupy Fort Lauderdale. You could message us through Occupy, or you could call me on my cell phone, which is 305-791-7359.
Thank you again, Susan. I thank you on behalf of Progressive News Network. Thank you for the work that you do. Keep up the good work, my friend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Susan Hawaii of Occupy Fort Lauderdale. Before we go on to our next guest, that would be State Representative Mark Pafford, a fantastic progressive Democrat who will be working for us in Tallahassee. I do want to mention some of our colleagues in the progressive broadcast arena. Gwen Holden-Berry and her show, There Be Monsters. Brian Stetton and his show, Progress Toward Democracy. Susan Nylon and the Nylon Report. Dennis Campbell has a TV show on YouTube. It's called Worldview on YouTube. So check it out. He has his own channel there. And also our friend Anita Stewart with her show, Wise Women Media. So these are good colleagues of ours, good progressives. Always good programming available for you to hear the work that progressive activists are doing across the state. I'm your host, Richard Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. And now I'd like to bring you Representative Mark Pafford. Welcome, Representative Pafford. How are you today, sir?
I am fine, thank you. How are you?
Very good, sir. Very good. I want to welcome you once again to Progressive News Network. We saw an interesting comment that you made on Facebook about the fact that the governor is insisting on using bogus facts when he meets with Ms. Sebelius. Do you want to talk about that a minute?
Yeah, I think it's quite amusing, actually, that you've got a governor who maintains that Affordable Care Act is philosophically something that he's opposed to, now using facts that he's, for the most part, that he knows are incorrect to support his claims. And I think the fact that you got a sitting governor requesting a meeting to, as he had described at one point, negotiate how the federal law would be implemented in the state of Florida and talk about Medicaid expansion and all that comes with that. And he lays on the table what should be thoughtful, precise information and provides bogus, as you say, or false numbers to support whatever claim that he's trying to make. You know, once again, you've got a fanatic governor who obviously is in his own reality on this, and he's trying to make decisions for 19 million people at the expense of some of the most vulnerable people. It's really shameful what he did.
Well, you know, if you look at the Republican argument, it's there for all to see up on the Republican website, that they think this is going to be too costly. And of course, it's interesting that when he was told that because there are so many uninsured, that means that Florida is going to get more money, that argument doesn't seem to faze him. He seems ready all the time to turn down federal money.
You know, he's I can't think of any other way to describe his behavior is utterly ignorant. I'm shocked that he is an attorney. I am shocked that he seems to have no reality or know-how or understanding of you know, what government is, whether it be a federal, state, or local issue. And instead, you know, he governs on this superficial philosophical nonsense. And, you know, people, I think, are beginning to call him out. I think the question in his mind is, and I think that's why he's playing these games, can he move those approval numbers up high enough where he doesn't risk a primary in, you know, the 2014 elections? I think that's his biggest concern right now.
Well, it seems that from the reports, the state economist even told him that those numbers are based on a false assumption. And go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's look, you know, I think it's Amy Baker. There's, you know, a trail of evidence in this case where he was warned not to use those numbers, and he's gone ahead and used them. You know, and whether it's his staff or not, you know, I can tell you anytime I look to use numbers, I always want to fact check things, especially, you know, if I were going to Washington, D.C. to meet with the Secretary of Health and Human Services on a matter that you sued the federal government over. It really is astonishing.
Well, you know, you wonder, is it a case where he's just a fact averse like so many Republicans, or is the fact that he's spent a lot of time in his professional career in the Medicare industry, and now he wants to steer Florida residents into HMOs? Hard to imagine that it's not a conflict of interest somewhere.
You know, it might be a conflict, but it's hard for any member of the legislature who's working an outside job, or the governor, you know, to basically argue that whole conflict argument. You know, yes, he was in healthcare, but, you know, we've had attorneys that are attorneys that are governor. We've had, you know, other professionals and many other types of professions where, you know, the state determines what policy is going to be, what laws are going to be made. I think in each case you could probably argue conflict. I think in this governor's case, you know, the question would be, is he acting in a malicious way? I mean, there's just been so many times that, you know, we can basically list from the day he was elected that he's been performing for the Tea Party, you know, and not only is he almost a silly puppet at this point, but he will say or do anything to keep whatever base he thinks remains, you know, supportive of whatever he's doing. And, you know, this latest item, you know, using false numbers in a meeting yesterday and then, you know, having a press conference to tout the meeting as positive, it's remarkable that nobody's really calling him out. Obviously, you are, and that's great. But, you know, this is a big, big issue when an elected governor misrepresents the facts purposely. That's a big issue. And you have to wonder, you know, if he's this blatant or this careless about it, what other things he's also, you know, misleading people on.
You know, I mean, the case that they make on the Republican website, and I'm sure this represents their thinking, is that, you know, when this new care package comes in, it's going to represent, there'll be an expansion in the number of people served. Now, instead of thinking like many of us do, well, okay, that means more people will have access to health care, he's immediately concerned that more people are going to be cared for, therefore the costs are going to go up and the federal money will not be there. And he's essentially saying... Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, somewhere in his mind, he can't fathom that this state being number 5, by the way, in the corporate taxes that corporations... It's the 5th best in the nation. He doesn't understand that there is a nexus, that there is a connection to revenue and quality of life and building a state with an infrastructure that supports those who need it, building an infrastructure that that has diverse economies. He's a very simple person. There's no other way to describe this. His actions are just so absurd at this point. It's really hard and unintelligible almost to make sense of these things. He's more concerned of slipping to 6th than he is raising mental health above 49th or education above whatever, 48, 49. The biggest issues that he has to deal with aren't necessarily those tax rates for the wealthiest corporations and people of the state. It's paying attention to the people he claims to have been one of. Specifically, his background being, you know, a poor family. It's astonishing that he is so disconnected to Floridians. And it's frankly astonishing that we could elect this guy, considering the amount of damage he's going to do, not only during his first 2 years, but for the next 2.
You know, I thought it was ironic. I was looking through the Republican pages, and it says, well, you know, The biggest danger, besides the fact that the federal government may not come through with the money, even though they promised to fund it fully 100% for the first 4 years, is that it's gonna hurt Florida's ability to spend money on education. It's almost funny. It really is.
You would have to laugh. I mean, look, you know, it's I've used as many words as I can think of to describe what I think of it.
You've been generous, Mark. But, you've been generous.
I've really tried to be nice too, but you know, I find it sometimes hard to describe how bad he is, and the complete amount of destruction that he will be responsible for by the time his first term is up. And, you know, whether it's destroying the Department of Health, whether it's closing TB hospitals, whether it's, you know, continuing to give the wealthiest breaks in the state and, you know, turning his back quite literally on people who may die or have died, and that could be, the 100,000, well, it's 85,000 seniors that are in frail conditions that need help to stay out of nursing homes, the 21,500 people with disabilities, some waiting for a decade for services, he hasn't paid any attention to them. He's done nothing. In fact, he's his first year, he actually had somebody on his staff come to a appropriations meeting and say that, you know, we wanted to get rid of the Department of Health, he did, and allow nonprofit agencies to care for those people. And in the event that they could not find a nonprofit health agency, you know, they were on their own. I mean, it's perhaps the most callous administration I can recall. And, you know, I think you'd find a lot of Republicans thinking the same.
You know, I'm a beneficiary, as are any American alive today, of the wonderful investment in infrastructure that we saw in the 30s, the WPA, the Public Works projects, the Eisenhower Highway projects. You know, you would think that someone who wants to work in leadership of government would want to build a better tomorrow for his state or for his country. And we've seen people capable of that. Here we've got a governor who was offered money to improve the transportation infrastructure. He couldn't even see his way to do that. Clearly, this is not a man who's investing in the future. This is a man who wants to, I guess, downsize to the point of those private enclaves, you know, a state
yep.
for the rich only. Mark, let me ask you. Go
yeah.
ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm. Go ahead. I'm all yours.
Okay, I was just going to say one other thing. I was wondering if you could address, and like I said, maybe it's not your focus, but can you talk a little bit about some of the changes that are happening and what Tallahassee's envisioning for the future in terms of the foreclosure problem? We see the feds have decided that they're not going to really do much more than slap the backs of the hand of these bankers, and we hear that the Tallahassee Republicans want to streamline it to make sure that the banks can get those homes faster. Can you give us any shed any light on that, sir?
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing new. Look, you know, there are a lot of parallels between Washington and the giveaways to the banks and the lenders. And Florida, you know, it's not much different. And it's unfortunate largely because of some of the things that have gone on over the last number of years in terms of, you know, banks trying to seize these homes and properties. Without any justification or paperwork, without any type of real effort to see if they, you know, some of these folks had qualified for loans and these type of things. And it's not surprising, largely because, you know, these lenders and the banks have such an incredible grip on lawmakers. You know, I think perhaps the biggest issue that involves everything we've talked about, I may question whether or not Governor Scott really cares, frankly, about anybody that's contributed to his campaign, because he seems to be just out there on his own. But generally speaking, you know, there is always this great desire to give back to people who make contributions. In the case of, you know, banks, in the case of the gun lobby, in the case of the insurance lobby, you know, it's really nothing new that we're seeing. You know, we're supposed to take up ethics reform along with elections reform. You know, I really doubt that we're going to see any type of ethics reform coming from a elected body who most of the leadership, I'm sure, are quite pleased with the amount of money that's come in. I think, you know, when it comes to that control that campaigns try to get over certain policies by, you know, investing quite literally dollars into campaigns, that's not going to change. I think the only thing that may change under the guise of election reform would be the independent type of political committees out there that are speaking on their own behalf. You know, my guess would be, and Democrats probably would, you know, appreciate this to a certain extent too, getting those dollars moved away from those independent political committees and back to the party structure. Just merely because of the control you have once you control those dollars. I can't imagine the Republicans were pleased this cycle with the amount of money that was spent by third-party political, you know, committees set up to badmouth people. You know, historically, that's always gone to the parties, a tremendous amount of those dollars. And so, you know, under the guise of ethics reform, or, I'm sorry, campaign reform or ethics reform, you'll probably see an effort to redirect those dollars back to where they, quote unquote, should be.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you again, but let me ask you one last question before you leave, sir. You're just about to begin a new legislative session. Do you have any goals for this session for yourself? For the Democrats of Florida's legislature, or is it going to be, you think, largely a holding action?
No, you know, I think the fact that we have more than, you know, 30% is important, but, you know, what people have to understand, so we can use the rules a little bit more to our advantage by having, you know, that those numbers in the House, 44 rather than under 40. However, you know, the Republicans in both chambers have a very large majority, and so things are going to continue as they always have, with the political twist of a gubernatorial election in 2014. My goal has always been to take a deep breath and try to bat down every crazy idea that comes at us.
You've been doing a great job, too.
Well, I appreciate it. It's you don't know it sometimes because it just comes at you so often, but thank you. But, you know, my job also as the policy chair of the caucus is to help provide information so members are able to make very, very informed decisions. And, you know, we've got, I think, 24 new caucus members in our Democratic caucus, as opposed to the 19 that came back. And so, as you can imagine, and I'll be the first to tell you, being a freshman in the legislature is not an easy task. You're not only learning structure and how to do things and you know, the process, but you're also trying to get speed on, you know, probably 200 different issues at one time. And so, you know, if anything, my job is to keep my head above water, work as hard as I can for the folks that actually sent me here, and get out of this two-year commitment and do, you know, put everything I have into it. I only look at it as 2 years because elections provide the, you know, opportunity for people to change their mind about everybody. And nothing is taken for granted as far as I'm concerned. If and when, because term limits will happen at some point, you know, I depart the legislature, I don't ever want to look back and say to myself, you know what, you should have been louder, you should have taken a stance. I don't want that to be the case. I want to try to use every second of this great honor to do my best, and that's really all I can say about my plan.
Well, Mark, thank you so much. We know that you do a very good job for us all in Tallahassee. Keep up the good work, and thanks for all that you do.
You bet, and thanks as always for having me on. And I think we actually made it through an entire interview without any phone problems.
I know. It was amazing. Thanks so much, sir.
It's shocking. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Well, as the fates would have it, not without some technical difficulties. I had a little dropout in the station. But that being said, before we go on to our next guest, I do want to read you this little excerpt. It is Senator Bernie Sanders' comment on Jack Lew, who's nominated for Treasury Secretary. He says, "As a supporter of the president, I remain extremely concerned that virtually all his key economic advisors have come from Wall Street. In my view, we need a Treasury Secretary who is prepared to stand up to corporate America and their powerful lobbyists and fight for policies that protect the working families in our country. I do not believe that Mr. Lew is that person. We don't need a Treasury Secretary who thinks that Wall Street deregulation was not responsible for the financial crisis. We need a Treasury Secretary who will work hard to break up the too-big-to-fail financial institutions so that Wall Street cannot cause another massive financial crisis. We do not need another Treasury Secretary who believes in deficit-neutral corporate tax reform. We need a Treasury Secretary willing to fight to make sure that large, profitable corporations pay their fair share of taxes to reduce the deficit and create jobs. We don't need a Treasury Secretary who will advise the President that he should negotiate with Republicans to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid benefits. We need someone who is going to strengthen these programs. And we don't need another Treasury Secretary who believes that NAFTA and the permanent normal trade relations with China have never been good for the American economy. We need someone in the White House who works for the fundamentally rewrite our trade policy to make sure that we are exporting American goods, not American jobs. That's Senator Bernie Sanders on Jack Lew. Now, ladies and gentlemen, for our next guest, the state senator, Mr. Jeff Clemons. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Senator Clemons. Good morning.
Good morning, Richard. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you, sir. Here we are approaching another legislative session, and we can count on our good Democrats, Senator Clemons, to be starting at a full gallop. Sir, tell me, what are you working on right now?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about being in the Senate as opposed to being in the House for the past 2 years is that you can file an unlimited amount of bills, whereas in the House you could only file six. So, you know, that's a great advantage. I guess it could be a disadvantage as well. We know that there have been senators who have filed as many as 70 or 80 bills in one session. So I'm trying to focus on things that I think are important and that, you know, that I really think I can spend some good quality time working on. And since I've been appointed to the Ethics and Elections Committee in the Senate, which was very important to me, it's one of my top choices, I've decided that I want to at least focus a good portion of my legislation on ethics and elections law and changes. And Richard, as you well know, and anybody listening knows, we had a debacle of an election in November when we have people waiting in line 7 hours to vote. And there was a study out of Central Florida that showed that those lines did contribute to turning many people away from the polls. And so, you know, I've been working on a couple things that I think will help. And I filed a few bills this week that I think will go a long way towards trying to fix some of the election problems we have here in the state.
Well, you are here in Florida. There are so many challenges for those of us who actually believe in democracy. Although I understand that our Republicans in Tallahassee have already come up with a solution, they're going to add one more day. Do you think that's a solution of any kind, sir?
You know, politics is always a negotiation to a certain extent, and what I've seen the ruling party in Tallahassee become very, very good at is figuring out where they want the end result to be, and then they start out to the right of that, and then they allow themselves to think that that they've moved in the direction of compromise because they started out to the right of that. So the bill that was filed that would add one day, I think that is significant in that one day is the Sunday before election, and that to me was one of the most egregious portions of House Bill 1355 that we passed in the legislature on long partisan lines. A lot of bad things in that bill, but the most egregious one was the one that didn't allow supervisors of elections to have early voting on the Sunday before the election. And to me, there was just clearly a racist portion of the bill. I mean, you're talking about you know, thousands or tens of thousands of African Americans that have a tradition of going to the polls on Sunday, souls to the polls over the past decade, and because they were trying to limit the Democratic vote, they said the supervisors couldn't hold that vote on a Sunday. I mean, it was appalling. I mean, it was bad enough that they were limiting the amount of hours or the amount of days that we could vote, but taking that day away specifically was disgusting. So what I see in that amendment is them throwing out a little bone, you know, saying, oh, well, we'll expand it one more day. And but what I expect is that they're going to come back to the position of taking it back to, you know, 13 or 14 days, and then they can say they compromised, and they can talk about how generous they were to be able to place the voting number of voting days back where it was before. So I fully expect, and I've gotten indications from Senate leadership that will be replaced, and the full number of early voting days will be reinstituted. But I want to make sure, as progressives, that we don't get too caught up in voting days, because while the days are important, the more important thing is that the locations are expanded. You know, we have just so many troubles, especially in South Florida. There just aren't enough locations, and the state legislature has restricted it to only certain buildings. And if you're wondering why the state legislature has restricted it to only certain buildings, the answer is simply that they're scared that if they make it available in more places, that more Democrats will vote. And there was even one legislator about 7 or 8 years ago who was quoted as saying, you know, he doesn't want to have voting on college campuses because college students tend to vote Democrat. You know, I want progressives everywhere that listen to your show to just be aware that while the number of days is important, it's even more important that we give supervisors of elections flexibility in where to locate their polls to make sure that, you know, that people don't have to travel long distances and wait in long lines in order to be able to vote.
You know, that brings up another point entirely, and I think you're very, very smart to take it beyond that number of days and take it to the location issue. You know, I hate to be the one to point out the bad news, but Florida is by far not unique in that we have seen the other party, let's be generous, restrict, limit hours, days, locations, and to have a peculiar, maybe even racial bias in what kind of facilities, what kind of equipment. I mean, this is not a unique situation. And I wonder, at what point does the Justice Department have to notice this? I mean, how egregious does it have to be? You know, do they have to start scraping skin cells before they say, hey, there's a racial component to this? That this is more than just party politics. This is about a group of people that are really trying to tamper. And I don't think there's any pleasant way to say it, to tamper with Americans' right to vote. I think it's a very serious issue, and I am troubled when I see it played out as a, well, you know, everybody plays certain games. No, you know, I've never seen Democrats go out of their way to restrict voting, to do these sampling of the electorate to see who we can disqualify real quick. Does that trouble you at all?
It's disturbing, and I will tell you that the Justice Department has, in some cases, looked at Florida, specifically, you know, with the passage of House Bill 1355. There were some challenges. 1355. This is the bill, the sweeping elections reform, and I saw it in every committee because I was the ranking Democrat in government operations and in state affairs, which is where this bill came first. And I asked the House sponsor, a gentleman named Dennis Baxley out of Ocala, very conservative legislator and also the author of the Stand Your Ground law. I asked him what was he trying to fix by the passage of this bill? Where was the fraud? Point to the fraud that you're talking about that your bill fixed. And I'm not saying there isn't ever any electoral fraud, but I wanted to know what his bill fixed. And in three separate meetings, he was never able to give me a real answer about what fraud that bill fixed. And he kept saying things like, you know, don't question my motives. Don't question my motives. You can question the legislation, but don't question my motives. And you know, that was his big defense. But I will tell you, since that legislation has been passed, and now more and more every day the truth comes out about it, it calls all of his motives into question, all the motives of the people that pushed that legislation into question. We've heard over the past year or so, former Republicans, the former chairman of the Republican Party, former governor of Florida, talk about how there were definite discussions about how they were crafting this legislation to limit people's ability to be able to vote, specifically to limit Democrats' turnout. And that's no way to win an election. If you have better ideas, you shouldn't have to cheat to win. And, you know, it got even more disturbing than that. A little over a month ago, there was an article, and unfortunately it didn't receive as much wide dispersion, but they interviewed the former chairman, or it might be the current chairman, of the Alachua County GOP, who said that he had had discussions with Representative Baxley about all the college students that were coming to Gainesville and voting on these local issues. And he was tired of the college students voting and deciding what they wanted their local government to look like. And he felt it was interference. And so he personally requested that Baxley draft that portion of the bill that makes it harder for college students and people who are transient to change their voting location as we get closer to the election. Now, that's disgusting. I mean, here you have a GOP county chairman admitting that he colluded with a state representative to make it harder for college students to vote simply because he didn't like how they voted on certain issues, including the election of Gainesville's first ever gay mayor. Didn't like it. So if you don't like having a gay mayor, then you'd go out and you try to restrict people from being able to vote. That's their solution.
Well, it sounds absolutely undemocratic to me, if not felonious.
It is, and we're trying to fix some things. I filed a bill just earlier this week, Senate Bill 234, that would bring a form of automatic voter registration to Florida. It would basically, when you go into the DMV now, they ask you whether or not you want to register to vote. This flips it and twists it so that when you go in to get your license and you're 18 and you're an eligible voter, you're an eligible U.S. citizen, it automatically registers you to vote unless you want to opt out. And so this kind of automatic voter registration, to me, solves a lot of the problems that we've been dealing with third-party registration groups and deciding, you know, who should be registered to vote and who shouldn't. It basically automatically registers 85% to 90% of eligible Floridians. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to vote, but it means that we get past this hullabaloo about who's registered and who's not registered. And if you think back to it, the voting registration system was originally created to make sure that they knew exactly who was voting and who was not voting. In other words, it created back in the day when we didn't allow African Americans to vote, when we didn't allow women to vote. So they had this voter registration system to make sure that no African Americans and women voted. I hope that we've moved past those times, although considering some of the legislation passed, and it makes you wonder, but I hope we've moved past those times and we don't need to have this archaic voter registration system when we can just register every eligible adult to vote, and if they vote or they don't vote, that's their own choice.
Right. You've got some other legislation in play. Why don't you talk about some of your other pieces?
Sure. Filed Senate Bill 234 this week. I also filed Senate Bill 254, which limits the amount of constitutional amendments that the legislature can place on any one ballot. In addition to all the problems they caused with House Bill 1355, the genius of the legislature caused them to place 11 constitutional amendments on the ballot in November of 2012. And for me, there was no greater contributor to the fact that these lines were so long, especially in early voting, than these 11 constitutional amendments. It made these ballots 6, 7, 8 pages long in some counties. And it was frivolous. The voters rejected the vast majority of them because they didn't belong on the ballot and they didn't belong in our Constitution. And so this to me was egregious, and it was done on purpose. I mean, they placed that many ballots. I firmly believe they placed that many items on the ballot for two reasons: to drive out conservative voters who wanted to vote for, say, Amendment 1, which was rejecting Obamacare, which, you know, you can't do. I mean, state law does not supersede U.S. law. And so it was really a worthless amendment placed on there simply for them to be able to rile up crowds and get them upset about the Affordable Care Act. And that's just one example of these amendments that really had no place in our Constitution and no place on the ballot, but were placed on there simply to rile folks up and bring out a conservative base. And then the second purpose of it, obviously, was to frustrate people who didn't want to spend a lot of time in line. And it shouldn't be a shock to anybody, Richard. We told everybody, and we mentioned it in committee meeting after committee meeting and on the floor repeatedly, this is going to result in making it more difficult for people to vote, and it's going to cause problems. And then when it did, everybody seemed surprised.
Amazing. You know, I am so beyond appalled at the shenanigans that this Republican legislature has been doing. Once again, we get people who don't run on these social issues, and should we expect to see another batch of anti-woman, anti-choice legislation, even though there was no talk of it during the election season?
Yeah, you know, that's I will see it because it'll always be filed, but I think it's going to be really interesting this session to see whether or not what happened in the last election really affects the majority party right now. This is the first time in well over years that the Democrats gained seats in the House and the Senate here in Florida of a significant amount, and even though they still control, you know, have a pretty tight grip on the legislature, it's still, for instance, you know, 26-14 in the Senate, 26 Republicans. I at least some of the early language hints that they understand that their party is a little out of step. Now, you know, what happens when they continue to try to reach out to their base again? I'm not sure, but I think that's going to be the most interesting thing to watch in the state legislature this year, is whether or not they want to deal with social issues, and or whether or not they want to try to find a way to better govern in our state. And I get the sense, at least in the Senate, that Senate President Don Gates, who's from the Panhandle and certainly a conservative legislator, but it doesn't necessarily feel like taking on some of these social issues that the Republicans have pushed over the past few years, and that he wants to concentrate on other things. And, you know, the Senate is a very independent body, and that won't stop people from filing bills, and it might not even stop a committee chair from hearing some of those more socially minded bills. But my hope, and I hope it's not naive, is that there will be at least a little bit of a shift after the realization that everything that they did to try to keep people from voting in Florida and to block people from coming out to the polls actually backfired. And you know, look, there's, if you're African American and you're over 50, you know people, or maybe you yourself couldn't vote at one time in your life. And, you know, I think that the African American community came out strong because they said to people like Rick Scott and to the other people who passed this bill, you know what, you can try to keep us down, you can try to hold us back, you can try to cut us out from exercising our democratic rights, but we're going to show you and we're going to come out. And I think the real fear for Republicans should be if they continue traveling along the same path that they have over the past few years, 2014 is going to be even worse with the governor up for re-election.
You know, I have been a student of politics for a long time, and I remember not too long ago that, and I guess this was back in 2004, was the big push, that if they just cut taxes, if they just cut taxes, the economy is going to take off like a jet plane, and even though they cut taxes, there'll be no reduction in services. Well, that song has sort of changed, and now the governor's cutting more taxes for the manufacturing. Do you think the state can continue to cut taxes and maintain any kind of services?
Well, look, it's a $70 billion budget, but you know, the percentage of the budget that we're spending on healthcare is growing, and that doesn't mean we're giving a lot better services, but it is growing. And I think what we're going to see now as the economy turns is there will be a few more dollars available here and there. And what's disappointing about it, though, is that the attitude toward taxation hasn't really changed at all. And, you know, Florida's economy is not growing at any greater percentage rate than the rest of the United States. And its unemployment rate has certainly gone down. The unemployment rate has certainly gone down all over the country. So, you know, any economist really worth his salt will tell you that cutting taxes is not the best way to grow your economy. And certainly cutting taxes for businesses, I don't think, results in greater job creation. So, you know, it's frustrating to me. I understand the argument that Georgia and Alabama and our sister states that we compete with, they don't charge taxes, sales taxes on manufacturing equipment, and that we should be competitive with them. I get the caution argument, but you know what? Florida has a lot of things to offer that Georgia and Alabama don't. And you know, to continue to find ways to cut taxes for corporations while and the majority of Floridians, you know, need to worry about putting food on the table and being able to fill up their gas tank to get to work. And it just, it, to me, it's more a thumb in the, you know, kind of the eye of your average Floridian. So the $100 million that we'll lose by eliminating that manufacturing tax, you know, it's a significant amount of money. But to me, the more important thing is just this is it seems like we have a government that wants to work for corporations rather than for people.
Well, thank you so much. I do want to ask you one more question. As we face the coming legislative session, is there anything that you want to say to the progressive community? How can we help you? How can we help Democrats in the legislature? How can we help and add our foresight, our energy to the good work that you guys are doing?
Well, I appreciate that. Certainly the movements like Awake the State have been really successful in making sure that the message stays out there. We need to keep two things. We need to keep our network together, the network that we've kind of forged through these Obama campaigns. We can't let it go away again like we did in 2010. We won in 2008, we were happy, and then we let our network kind of fall by the wayside. 2010 came, we got a little lazy, and we've ended up with with a governor who doesn't seem to care about your average everyday Floridians, you know, for 4 years. We can't let that happen again. So keeping that network is in place and making sure whatever organizations you've been a part of and been active in, that you keep that going over the next 2 years is important, because we've got to win the governor's mansion. So that's number one. And number two, you know, meet with your legislators around the state. If you're listening to this around the state, even if your legislator is a conservative, they need to hear your point of view. And that, yes, they may not agree with you and you may not change their mind, but simply by going and meeting with them and telling them about your concerns, you might have the ability to at least dull that edge to get them to realize that they represent more than just corporations and the most conservative members of their society. And when I say go meet with them, I mean that literally. I mean make an appointment to go to their office, because sending emails is all fine and good, but it's really not an effective way to reach the heart of your legislator. You've got to go and sit in front of them. So I think it'd be fantastic if we saw more progressives, you know, going and making appointments with their legislators, even if they're Republicans, even if they're conservative. Those are the two things I think that would help the most.
Well, thank you so much, Senator. We really appreciate you joining us. And anytime we can be a platform for you to come out and speak to the audience, we're happy to do that. Thank you so much, sir.
All right. Thank you so much, Richard.
And best of luck in the legislative session ahead.
Appreciate it.
Okay, that's some pretty sage advice from Senator Clemens. You've heard from Susan Hawaii how to help your friends and fellow progressives and neighbors with Occupy foreclosure issues. You've heard from Representative Pafford, State Senator Clemens, and in just a minute, we're going to hear from a really unusually talented gentleman, an activist, a physicist, and a very, very talented musician. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Sky Nelson. Welcome, Sky.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. You come very highly recommended. one of the PDA premier national activists, our friend Michael Fox over in the West Coast has recommended you highly, and I have to say everything I've learned about you proves top-notch. Sky, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a physicist and musician as well as an activist. I worked very hard in the 2008 election, mostly for Obama, and then in this past election, I did work across the board for a lot for PDA, including Alan Grayson here in Florida. And we won. I was thrilled about that. Amit Berra is a progressive Democrat in the Sacramento area that won, just barely, but we won. And also a number of propositions, like the I fought for the labeling GMOs, genetically modified organisms campaign in California, and fought against Prop 8, which is the same-sex marriage ban in 2008. So that's some of my activist experience. I've also been involved with Occupy Santa Rosa since 2011. And I've actually been really one of the lead facilitators for our spokes council. So I've gotten a lot of chance to work with people sort of helping guide us to a collective positive outcome for some of the discussions we've had and the decisions we've had to make. And it's been overall a really enlightening experience for me.
Well, Sky, one of the questions I like to ask my activist guests is, for most people, it's more than enough to try to have a family and make a living. But some people, some extraordinary people, go beyond and above the call of duty, not only raising their families, having friends, and making that living, but they also believe they have to participate in making this a better society. What was it in your life, sir, that motivated you to go beyond just being a consumer and an academic?
Well, I have to, of course, recognize my parents, because I'm sure that everything they taught me was aimed in this direction, even though they weren't necessarily activists themselves. I think from a very young age, I saw that a lot of the adults in my life, I saw that there were problems in the world, and a lot of the adults I knew said, you know, the best thing we can do is raise our children well so that they can make a better world. And it sort of hit me that if I do the same thing, then my daughter's going to be faced with the problems that I couldn't solve. And so pretty early on, I felt like, you know, if it's going to happen, it's going to be me. And not, of course, just me, but all of us who say that statement. If it's going to happen, it's going to be me. And so I sort of decided, really at a spiritual level, that I really had to take on the ownership of a better world on myself. And I would say that comes from a sense of empowerment, you know, and sort of confidence, if you will, that I can make a difference. And I've developed a whole theory around the meaningful coincidences that basically points to that idea that the more we step forward with fighting for what we believe in, the more opportunities we get, unexpected opportunities to resolve the problems that we face. And so there's a real, I think, a physical law-based reason as to why we need to stand up. Not the person that I elect, but me needs to stand up and continue. Like Mr. Clemens was saying, I so appreciated keeping the network alive that we created during the Obama campaign and all the other campaigns recently that have been so strong, keeping that network alive and realizing we've got to keep doing the work. It's not President Obama who's going to do the work. It's us who's going to do the work.
Well, you know, you bring up a really interesting point, and I'm one of those people that believes that you can be both a spiritual person and a political person. A lot of people assume that if you're involved in spiritual quest, that that means you leave the world of politics alone, or that if you're a political person, because you're in the rough and tumble of politics, you can't also bring, a spiritual life experience into that arena. Obviously, you disagree with that idea.
Yeah, I do. Maybe that's true while you're studying, but when you're actually out there being a professional, whether it's a professional politician or a professional spiritual person, however you want to call it, I think that once you really dive back into the world, you know, the world is complex, and we can certainly make a difference by writing books. And I have written a book. My book is called Coincidence, The Physics of Unexpected Opportunities. And the idea is to share in an easy form the principles I've been working on and the implications they have so that people can read them and have it make a difference to them, if it does. And I think that we have to work from the ground up in that way to spread knowledge and spread awareness to each other. But there's also work that's involved. So I feel like I can't just sit there and write a theory and work on my theories and work on my presentations. I also have to show what I'm really believing, which is that we can't have some proxy do our political work for us. It has to be our own effort that's actually driving the progress. And to me, it's a spiritual principle. It's not just that I'm doing the work. You know, I'm not just making phone calls to the people that I'm calling. I'm setting an example. If you might put it this way, I'm setting an example in the universe. I'm setting an example in my life that we need to stand up and fight for what we believe in. And I think that that causes a trend toward the positive.
Well, you know, I was also very intrigued by your physics page. And I think that you brought an interesting, what I'm going to call an interesting duality, with kind of one eye toward quantum physics and one eye toward the spiritual practice, where synchronicity, or Kismet, or and the quantum principle of indeterminacy all kind of come together in a very interesting way. You want to talk a little bit about your theory?
Sure. I think it's really important to it's tempting in the spiritual world right now these days to connect quantum physics with spiritual ideas, and I think most of what's been done is not really accurate. So whereas it's common to think in some circles that we create our own reality, that kind of statement, I come to a conclusion that's not totally dissimilar from that, but it's not exactly right, that the world around us that we're not observing currently at the moment is actually undetermined. And this is a principle that we take from quantum mechanics, and I try and apply it to bigger objects like people and things in the macroscopic world. And I say that, you know, anything you haven't observed yet is not determined. It's in a combination of lots of different possible states. And by then interacting with whatever it is, you're collapsing it in a way, not only in the moment but retroactively to one particular outcome. And what this leads to is a possibility that if things are not yet determined, then when I walk out my door, depending on the types of actions I've been taking in my life, I can bring to myself, in a way, sort of attract, if you will, different experiences that are reflect the choices that I've made in my life. So what I mean practically is that by taking the time to make phone calls, you know, I made about, I think, about 5,000 phone calls between 2008 and 2012 elections to people in other states. By being willing to make those phone calls, I think that I'm bringing to myself, retroactively even, opportunities or positive results in the campaign overall, not just from the actions I'm taking. Now, this isn't to say that it can be very dangerous to start thinking, well, I'm controlling the election, and that's not what I mean. It's actually more subtle than that. But I'd have to get more into the physics to explain how that is. And what I'm doing this week is I'm traveling around Orlando, sort of central Florida area, and getting ready for the Positive Music Awards, which are happening this Sunday.
I understand you're an award winner.
Well, I'm a nominee, yeah, for a song called Live in Love that's nominated for Transformational Award, I think. And the Positive Music Awards are put on by a nonprofit called EmpowerMA.com. And you can go to their website, www.empowerma.com. And they're wonderful supporters of positive music. And positive music is just really any music that has a message that is intended to enlighten or make us feel more connected to life. Or, you know, it's like you go through your day, you're singing the songs that you've heard in your head on the radio, and you want to be singing things that are actually going to make you feel like a better person and grow, not just things about broken hearts or, you know, losing your job or whatever. So positive music is a very broad category, and they're celebrating it by creating these awards. So I'm going for that, and in the meantime, I'm here a week early, and I spoke today at Unity of Melbourne, and speaking tomorrow night at Unity of Merritt Island, and Tuesday night at Unity Spiritual Life Center in Winter Springs, Wednesday night at Unity of the Villages. And then Friday, I'm doing a songwriting workshop for a bunch of kids from a local school. That's a volunteer thing. And then also Friday night, I'm going to be playing at the Oakbrook Center for Spiritual Living in Ocala. And then the Positive Music Awards are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And Sunday morning, I'm giving the talk and some music for the Center for Spiritual Living Tampa.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
So I'm all around. And if you want to find all that information, it's on my website, skynelson.com.
Why don't you go ahead and give that to him again?
www.skynelson.com.
That's
SKYNELSON. And you can just click on the calendar.
Let me ask you this. I'm sure you're familiar with the music of Tibet that is calculated to transform your awareness, to transform your perception.
Hey, go on. Continue.
I was just going to say I've had the good fortune to hear the music of the Dalai Lama's musical ensemble, the monks of Drepung Lhotse, and
wow.
the music with the horns and the cymbals is carefully calculated to bring about a spiritual transformation Wow. And a subtilization of awareness. And of course, you know, with their analysis of the birth and death passage, they have certain specific sounds and mantras that are used to aid in that transition. And I think that follows well in the same kind of concept of, you know, a positive music that is meant to not just, you know, be a happy tune, but to have some transformational capability itself. Guy, why don't you talk a bit about your music? When did you become a musician?
Well, I started playing when I was about three. My parents put me in some piano lessons, and I continued on that my whole life, really. I got picked up guitar when I was in high school, or middle school, actually, and started writing songs. I was composing, you know, little classical pieces. I started with classical music pretty early on, and then started writing pop songs in high school. And I've really been doing it my whole life. And then in college, I started at UC Berkeley, and I was a music major. And the first year, I had hand injuries of some sort and couldn't really practice as much as I needed to. So I switched majors. And as luck would have it, I chose physics and did some work to catch up, and took honors physics courses, and had a great time. I really loved it, and went on to get a teaching credential in California and teach physics in classrooms for a number of years, 5 years in high school classes, physics and math classes. And eventually, you know, teachers are on the front lines of not only child rearing, but also economic issues and everything else. So it was a very, very challenging position, and I think I would have done well over time if I had continued. But I decided I wanted to play music full time. So I left teaching and played music full time for about 2.5 to 3 years. And as luck would have it, right before 2008 election, right before the economy was crashing, I decided it was time for me to get a part-time job, and I did, which I still have today. And the rest of my time I spend playing music and traveling and speaking and studying physics.
Well, I think it's about time that we hear one of your tunes. So
sure.
I'm going to play the piece that you sent, Love Will Lead. And you want to introduce the tune or talk a little bit about it before we play it?
Sure. This song is one of my most recent ones. And it will be on some kind of upcoming album at some point in the future. This is, as it will be obvious from the lyrics, my motto is, think for yourself, do what you love, and the world will change. Think for yourself, do what you love, and the world will change. And it's really a motto that's about take charge of your own life and don't be a victim to other people, but rather really realize that we're all empowered to make a difference. And so that line is actually the first line of the song.
So you're the composer, lyricist, and arranger?
Yeah, and actually recording engineer for part of it. My friend Rick Roller did it in his studio for the most part, and he was a great influence on it. I think it turned out great.
Well, obviously you're a multi-instrumentalist. Do you play all the instruments on it, or do you have a small ensemble?
Yeah, I programmed all the instruments, and I played the ones that I couldn't program. And so I played the bass guitar, I played the electric guitar, I played the piano part, the strings part, and I sang all the vocals. I sang the lead vocals, and then Steve Barry and Veronique Della Bruna. Actually, Veronique is originally from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and she's a fantastic vocalist, and they joined me on the backup vocals.
Oh, great. Okay, let me go ahead and play this for us, and then you can talk a little bit more about it after we hear the piece.
Great. Thank you.
love the thing you've always done. It's only you can see your history. This love will lead you there. If everyone can see this picture, and love will be a friend.
Beautiful, Sky.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If your listeners go to skynelson.com and sign up for my email list, they get a free copy of that song, free download.
Well, that's nice. Is that, should we say, typical of the genre of music that you do?
Close. That one has influence of kind of a techno, you know, electronic feel with the beat and everything, which is a little bit of a new direction for me. I'd say it's close, though, in terms of I've got a poppy feel. Songs that are short in length and have choruses and verses that are well-structured, you know, so that I'm highly influenced by the Beatles and James Taylor and, you know, songwriters, singer-songwriters in general.
Well, very nice. Very nice music. So are you performing in Florida for a while as well as doing these lectures?
Well, each of the lectures is also includes music. So I do a few songs sprinkled throughout the talk. So it's combined, and that's what I listed earlier is the list of all the places I'm doing up until I go home next Monday. So I'm here for another week.
Well, great. And listen, now that we've heard some of your music, why don't you go ahead and run down those dates again?
Okay. So tomorrow I will be at Unity of Merritt Island at 7 o'clock p.m. That's Monday, January 14th. Tuesday, January 15th, I'll be at Unity Spiritual Life Center in Winter Springs, 7 o'clock p.m. Wednesday, I will be at Unity of the Villages at 6:30 p.m. And then Friday, January 18th, I'll be doing a songwriting workshop for students at a local school up at the Oak Brook Center for Spiritual Living in the afternoon. And then at 7 p.m. at Oak Brook Center for Spiritual Living, I'll be doing another of my conference workshop / concerts. And then Friday and Saturday and Sunday are the Positive Music Awards, which I recommend people come to if they like uplifting music. There's a lot of well-known positive music artists like Faith Rivera and Harold Payne and Karen Drucker that are going to be there, and we're all sharing music and being nominated for various awards, and there's a lot of fans and a lot of people who love music and want to support positive music, and so I invite everyone to come out and join that. It's a public event, and you can get tickets at www.empowerma.com. And then Sunday, January 20th at 11 in the morning, I'm just slipping away from the conference to go to the Center for Spiritual Living Tampa. So if you live in Tampa area, 11 a.m. on Sunday, January 20th, I'll be speaking.
Oh, that's great. Beautiful music, very, very lovely, very refreshing. Let me take you back to the world of politics for just one more minute. You spoke about working with an Occupy group. Did you say Santa Rosa?
Santa Rosa, yeah.
Tell me, what are the primary issues? I don't know if you caught Susan Hawaii from Occupy Fort Lauderdale talking about foreclosures. What are the primary focus issues for Santa Rosa Occupy?
Well, my disclaimer is that as of late, I haven't been particularly involved the past few months, but there's been some great stuff that they've been doing for the past, a year and a half, I guess. Foreclosures being a big one. Move to amend is very popular among our activists to amend the Constitution to get rid of corporate personhood, as you were talking about earlier with the Citizens United. I liked how you said the improperly named Citizens United case. And there was a really, really great campaign by a woman named Carolyn who, it wasn't by her, but it was a group that she was part of, and I spoke to her about it a lot, the flash napping campaign. Because in Santa Rosa, I believe that sleeping in public is not legal. And what this means is that it's illegal to be homeless. So there was a campaign to have flash naps where activists would be walking down the street dressed normally and then suddenly would lie down and right in front of City Hall and lie on the grass and take a nap. Protest the lack of ability for people to find a place to sleep in the first place because they've been evicted, and then to not be able to sleep in public or, you know, to basically become criminals. So that was a great campaign that I thought was very creative. There's been a lot of creative stuff with drama programs and, like theatrical productions at events that we've done, some fundraising. That gives you an idea of some of the various – it's very diverse. There was a free school that some people were running and think is still happening where there'd be gatherings every Thursday night or something for just education on relevant issues to what we were talking about. And I think what I found is that if there is anything that both is a strength and a weakness for Occupy, it's that it's so diverse in topic. And I know you've probably heard this before from somewhere, but it has made it hard to actually move forward on one particular topic in a political way. I know that a lot of folks in Occupy that I've known have not been very interested in politics. And I think that that's a mistake. I think that I understand where they're coming from, that politics really, in a way, is being bought and sold by corporations, and we want to just go completely outside that system. But I come from a bit of a more pragmatic point of view that we need to change the system from the inside, or from the bottom up. And that's why, like you were asking earlier, that's why my own spiritual calling has been to enter back into the political world and make calls for people that I care about. Like, people in Occupy Santa Rosa would have loved Alan Grayson, and I was frustrated that I couldn't really get people to get on the phone and make calls for Alan Grayson because he's this great progressive Democrat in Florida who's running for the United States Congress. So I think that that's been a shortcoming, and it's also been a strength because Occupy is not co-opted by any one group or organization or idea.
If you would give one final message to our progressive listeners out there in terms of how to engage, how to build a better world, what would you say, sir?
Well, for one thing, I do want to take a second to list a number of successes that I jotted down on my paper here.
Please
that
do.
Make me very optimistic right now. And just like Senator Clemens, I'm optimistic in a very, what might I say, I don't know, a mature optimism. I'm not naive about what our chances are. I think there are very strong tendencies towards the kind of shenanigans that we've seen from, I guess, Florida Republicans, but also from the National Republican Party. I think that there was a trend in this last election that, to an extent, marginalized some of the Republican views. It became clear that, you know, they weren't really – they were basically the party of white males, which I am one, but they were not –
It's not fully representative of your position, I think.
Right. They were obviously not representing the Mexican vote, for instance, or the Latino American vote, excuse me. And for instance, as one small example, and that became clear, like, you know, who do these people represent in the end? They're not representing the modern America. And I think that there's many ways in which the Republican Party was somewhat exposed in this past election and made just a little bit more irrelevant in a way. And some of the campaigns I was excited about, like I said, Amy Barra won, Alan Grayson won. I fought for Norman Solomon, who was a great progressive Democrat from actually my hometown of Point Reyes in Northern California. And hopefully next year we'll get him on the ballot, or next time around. You know, I was very encouraged 2 years ago when we got Governor Jerry Brown in California back into office. He was a pretty good fighter for a middle-of-the-road Democratic point of view. Pragmatic, but and Barbara Boxer stayed in office, who has been a longtime Democrat, and she was up for re-election against some pretty terrible conservative corporate CEO types. So I'm very happy about that stuff, and I think that my message is we have to stand up for what we believe in, but not just to fight for, you know, the issues right now, but to make a statement that it's only going to happen if I stand up and make a difference. It's not enough for me to elect somebody else to do my work for me, because it's not actually the work itself that's making the difference. It's your attitude and your energy of taking responsibility. And this is not just, you know, painful. It is painful for me every time I have to take time out of my life. I have a 3-year-old daughter, and I'm very busy. And every time I have to take time out of my life to make phone calls to people in other states, it's a little bit hard. But at the same time, from that point of view, I realize how empowered I am to really make a change, and not just in the lives of the people that I'm calling, but also I believe from my physics work in this sort of global way, I'm creating a new type of model of thought where people are taking responsibility for their planet, and I think we need to do that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Sky. I really appreciate it, and best of luck with your tour, and I know you're going to make a lot of people happy and bring I have to call a good vibration wherever you go. Thanks again.
Thanks, Rick, for doing the show. Have a great day.
Okay. You take care, my friend. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that brings us toward the end of another Progressive News Network. I want to thank my co-producer, Ms. Mickey Royce, for all her efforts to help you bring this show. I want to tell you that next week we have another great lineup of wonderful, interesting people. We're going to have Meredith Ackman, president of the Palm Beach County Now, and also vice president of the state of Florida Now. Also, we're going to have a special guest, Mr. Lee Tiger, a wonderful musician, and Miccosukee Indian, who's going to be talking about his new album coming out, and also his experience in the life of a Florida native. Also, we have some other special guests in mind, so I hope you join us next week. Thanks for coming. This is Richard Spezak, news director, saying there's a better world coming. So you keep your shoulder to the wheel.
When there was earth to plow or guns to bear arms, I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly down. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with the drum. Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime?
I mentioned to you earlier William Black. He's the author of a book called Best Fleet, Bob Event is to Own One. He's professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Former senior financial regulator. His recent article for the Huffington Post is called Pink Blue, Another Brick in the Film. William Black's people and Mr. Lou. Well, on financial matters, says William Black, Jack Lou has been a failure of pretty epic proportion.
Buddy, can you spare
he gets promoted precisely because he's willing to be a failure and so is useful to Wall Street interests. So you've mentioned two things in terms of the most important and most destructive deregulation under President Clinton by statute. But he was also there for much of the deregulation by rule and a strong proponent of it. And he was there for much of the cutting of staff. For example, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, lost 3/4 of its staff. And that huge loss began under Clinton. And the whole reinventing government, Lou was a strong supporter of that. And for example, we were taught, instructed by the Wall Street, and Wall Street in Washington, that we were to refer to banks as their clients and as our role as regulators and to think of them as clients of the regulators. He goes from there to Wall Street, and when he was a complete failure, you noted that part of what Citicorp did was bet that housing would fail, and that's exactly one of their winning bets. But they also made a bunch of losing bets as well, and the unit he was heading would not have been permissible but for the deregulation of getting rid of Glass-Steagall under Clinton. And you saw as an example of Citicorp why we shouldn't be doing this. Why would we create a federal subsidy where all of us, through the U.S. government, are on the hook for Citicorp's gambling on financial derivatives for its own account? You know, running a casino operation. That makes absolutely no sense. And then he comes to the Obama administration, where he was disastrously wrong. He tried very hard to impose austerity on the United States back in 2011, which is, he wanted you to know, the European strategy, which has pushed the Eurozone back into recession, Spain, Greece, and Italy into a Great Depression level of unemployment. And this guy, after all these failures, who is also intellectually dishonest, will not own up to his role in the deregulations role and the desupervision role in producing the crisis. Not just this crisis, but the Enron crisis as well, and the savings and loan debacle. So says William Black on Mr. Lou. Well, thanks again. Hope you join us next week. And as a friend of mine said in the film Harvey,
Fly specks. I've been spending my life among fly specks while miracles have been leaning on lampposts at 18th and Fairfax.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to say goodnight for Progressive News Network. We'll see you next week.
They said the students scared the guards or the troops were battle dressed. Before my was in their new degree, the bachelor's. apples, useless wars, and racial strife. The next time there's a riot, well, you better stay out of sight. When there's a riot going on, when there's a riot going on.
And good night, ladies and gentlemen, for Progressive News Network. We'll see you next week.